I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith Middleton. This show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Back in the days when rock and roll was still young and three-chord bands were popping up everywhere, the Grateful Dead were unique in just about every way. They fused multiple music styles, rock, blues, folk, R&B, country, jazz, and of course, more than a peppering of psychedelia. They were known for their long jams and extensive touring schedule. They had meager beginnings in Palo Alto, California, but went on to develop a huge fan base around the world. Now, 50 years later, the fans are still devoted, and there are more of them all the time. You may remember some of their more popular songs. Songs like Truckin', Touch of Grey, Ripple, and Friend of the Devil, just to name a few. The band members had their personal and professional ups and downs and extraordinary challenges. If you had the chance to see just one of their shows, you never forgot it. Colorful tie-dyes and the scent of patchouli and pot mingling with the sweat of twirling fans known as Deadheads. Dreadlocks, children, bare feet, all part of the experience. But the music and the lyrics had the ability to transcend the Deadhead scene and capture listeners across the spectrum. Much has been written about the Grateful Dead, with over 100 books out there on the band, including this new one by my guest, David Brown. Brown's written extensively about the Dead. He's a music critic and journalist. He's a contributing editor of Rolling Stone and Men's Journal. Brown's work has appeared in the New York Times, Entertainment Weekly, The New Republic, and other publications. He's written several books. His latest is So Many Roads, The Life and Times of the Grateful Dead. He lives in New York City. David Brown, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lori. Great to be here.
This book is laid out in a really interesting way. You start each chapter with a key date in the band's history. Can you talk about the structure and why you chose to do it that way?
Sure. Well, I think one of the big challenges anybody writing about the Dead at this point in time faces is what new or fresh approach or new information can you bring to the story? Because like you said, there have been numerous books written about them. People blog about them regularly and dig deep into the history. So that was one of the first things that crossed my mind. I had access to their archives, which are housed at the University of California in Santa Cruz, which has just come together over the last couple of years. So that was one new aspect I could bring to it. I got access to documents and old contracts and correspondence and things that are used in the book. But yes, I thought, well, structurally, I'm a huge fan of, I guess, what we call micro-histories. Just zero in on one moment in time and really delve deep into that. So I thought, well, what if each chapter was about one significant or pivotal day or a couple of days in their story? And I thought that would allow me to give the book a kind of almost like a novelistic feel. I think that's another thing I was after. The Dead is such a colorful world, from the people in it, the musicians, to people they worked with, to where they lived and worked. I mean, it's all very vivid and colorful. And I thought, well, that approach would also, I'd be telling a story, not so much just laying out the facts.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah, thank you.
It was 50 years ago this month when the core of the Grateful Dead was formed. And these guys from different backgrounds and musical experiences start out pretty small and end up wildly successful.
Yeah, it was 50 years ago that basically the core group, which was Jerry Garcia, Bob Weir, Bill Kreutzmann, Phil Lesh, and Ron McKernan, known as Pigpen, start doing their first shows. Phil Lesh being the last one to join of that original band, at a pizza parlor in Menlo Park. The fact that they started in a pizza parlor in a shopping district in Menlo Park, California, gives you one sign of how far they came. They were playing stadiums by the end. Looking back on that and doing that research and talking to some of them about that and the friends who knew them at the time, it's almost a miracle that they came together and even lasted a week, much less, you know, all these decades, because the Dead are such an interesting contradiction. You know, the guys, and also include Mickey Hart, who joined 2 years after that, in 67, were so different from each other in so many ways. Their musical backgrounds were so different. You know, Jerry Garcia was at that point a bluegrass string band acoustic player who barely played rock and roll. You know, Bob Weir was a folk guy. Phil Lesh came from a classical music background. Bill Kreutzmann loved to play jazz, although he was also in R&B cover bands. Their personalities were very different. The age range, you know, Bob Weir was 7 years younger than Phil Lesh, which, when you're 16 and 23 or so, that's a big difference in terms of what you've seen of the world and you know, your musical experience. And the personalities, you know, were also very different. Jerry was the quote-unquote leader but didn't really want to be, and, you know, Weir was this kind of spacey teenager, and you know, it's kind of amazing that they clicked as a unit to begin with, but I think what they all had in common was that they were all, in one way or another, kind of outsiders. You know, they'd been kicked out of schools or weren't finding a place for themselves in the world one way or another, and they all had that drive to make it, which Jerry did. You know, for all of Jerry's kind of laid-back hippie image and all that, all those cliches we associate with him, he was a pretty driven, focused guy in his music, and it's really something that was continually reinforced to me doing interviews. And he'd be the first guy up in the morning when the band was living together briefly. He'd be the first one up at dawn practicing scales and really kind of pushing the guys, expressing a lot of his frustrations, you know, to his girlfriend at the time, Mountain Girl, who I interviewed numerous times through the book, and she remembers him coming home, you know, grumbling about the band, they're not playing well, and what's for dinner? He was a very smart guy, really bright, and open to a lot of things. And his personal life could be just chaotic from beginning to end. But I think he knew what he wanted. And it was even reinforced in when I was going through those archives. I found one yellow legal pad filled with notes from a band meeting in 1972 in which they were complaining all about, you know, their record company, and they should be reaching a bigger audience. And, you know, they did eventually leave that company, which was Warner Brothers. And, you know, things like that also reinforced how, despite their differences, despite the different personalities and musical backgrounds, as a unit, they had their eye on the prize. Mm. You know, they were not just a bunch of pot-smoking hippies. Oh, you know, it's funny, one of their former employees said to me, well, we weren't just a bunch of navel-gazing pot-smokers. Well, there was some of that, but not all the time.
This is David Brown. He's a music critic, journalist, and has written this book, So Many Roads, The Life and Times of the Grateful Dead. You mentioned there briefly their frustrations with the record company. The record company was also pretty frustrated with them.
They were. The Dead could spend a lot of time in the studio when they wanted, and could frustrate the producers that they worked with early on. And I think that's another recurring theme that came out in my research that I was aware of before to some degree, but was, again, just made more clear to me, was the world of the Dead was pretty intense and demanding. Again, the image we have, you know, those people who know, like, their Oxymoxoa album, there's a famous picture on the back cover with the band and their friends and girlfriends and crew all, like, hanging out in the sun and on a hill, you know, a communal feel. And they had that to some degree. But there was a kind of tough survival of the fittest atmosphere in that band. And that included just how they dealt with record companies, with the music business. They had a sort of take-no-prisoners aspect to them, whether, you know, they literally drove one producer out of the studio for good because they wanted to hear certain things in music that they couldn't hear, to making their other record company later on, like, they didn't want the contract to be long, so they had them do it, you know, single spaced with wide margin, so it was only two pages. You know, they were constantly being sort of fussy in particular, and they were with each other too.
There are numerous times throughout the book where you're describing the music that they're playing at the time, and they're beautifully written and so descriptive, including the times when they weren't playing so well.
Yeah, that was, you know, probably one of the fun parts of writing the book. For example, I focus on Dark Star, which is one of their early classics, if you will, a song that they played numerous times repeatedly over the course of those 20-something years after they wrote it.
And never the same way twice.
Yeah, it could be 10 minutes, it could be 30 minutes. It really allowed them to stretch out. It was one of those early moments when they really began to loosen up and experiment. Just listening to those performances, and one particular that I wrote about at a theater called The Family Dog on the Great Highway, where you hear that dynamic so well. There are these moments of beauty when they all come together. There's these discordant parts where certain instruments drop out and they come back together. You almost hear the instruments wrestling with each other for control of the band. Phil Lesh nudging Jerry's guitar out, and then they come back together, and then they fall apart again. And the story of the band, in some ways, is so evident in their music, and especially in performances like that, where you hear the cooperation, you hear the combativeness, you hear them pushing each other and pushing each other away and coming back together. It's the music was such an expression of the personalities in that band. It was really remarkable.
I'm talking with David Brown. He's author of this book, So Many Roads, The Life and Times of the Grateful Dead. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in for Faith Middleton. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with David Brown.
Look for a while at the child, the cat sunflower brown, walking jingle in the midnight sun. Come, but don't mold it, drip of silver, come on and like a breeze, quill starting through a dream.
I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in for Faith Middleton. We've been talking with music critic and journalist David Brown about his latest book, So Many Roads, The Life and Times of the Grateful Dead, out in time for the band's 50-year anniversary. David, you also weave in a lot of detail about what was happening in the world at the time, and not just in the world of the musicians. You describe at the beginning of the book Garcia's reaction to the Zodiac Killer.
Right.
Which was major headlines at the time, as well as the Cuban Missile Crisis and how that affected Garcia. It really adds a sense of time and place, as well as the overall feeling in the country at the time, and that showed up in his songs as well.
It's in his songs. It's in the intentionally random imagery in the Grateful Dead movie, which the director of the movie described to me. You mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of '62 when people thought all hell would break loose and there would be nuclear war. And, early on, the Dead started doing a song called Morning Dew, a cover version, a beautiful song that was inspired by the novel On the Beach, which was also a movie about survivors of a nuclear war in Australia waiting for the radioactive clouds, to come their way. And that's a song the Dead started performing not long after they got together, and they performed their way up, into the 90s. It's a very elliptical song. Like, it doesn't actually come out and say, there's been a bomb. All these just images of hearing voices and so forth. And I think the way he kept coming back to that song and using it stretching it out to often 15, 20, 30 minutes, exploring all kinds of instrumental chaos in it. I think that was probably, I think, as close to an expression of that moment as he allowed.
David, the Grateful Dead were often referred to as a 60s band, and it's been said there was a fair amount of wincing at that description.
That's another cliche, I think, about them, that they were kind of stuck in time. They really, I think they reflected their time more than a lot of people might think. I think the 70s, we all see that as the me decade and all that, and I think, again, the Dead reflected that in their way. That's when they started their own independent record company and wanted to release music on their own, which was a total foreshadowing of the music business now, where you have bands like Radiohead and so forth saying, you know, I'm leaving the record company, we're just going to put out our stuff digital. I think if the Dead were around now, they would probably be doing the same thing. But, you know, in the 70s, you know, it was their expression in a way also of that, worst case, we'd say, you know, the solipsism, narcissism of the 70s when, you know, we're not going to be about politics or community. We're just going to kind of hunker down ourselves. And I think them starting their own company and going off on their own path, even though it wasn't successful in the end, I think it was a real sign of that. You know, in the 80s, when they kind of got their act together, Jerry had a coma, of course, in 1986, a diabetic coma, but he got back to, you know, his health back, and in the following year, 87, when they had their big hit, Touch of Grey, they were relatively sort of clean and sober for them, and again, I think that also reflected that moment in time when you had a lot of the veteran rock stars doing the rehab thing or cleaning themselves up. That's when, you know, people like Steve Winwood suddenly looked like they were in the cover of GQ, or, you know, Glenn Frey from the Eagles was doing commercials for gyms, you know, for workouts and for exercise programs. It was this odd little moment when those kind of musicians were trying to look more together or something. And so I think the Dead reflected that as well. I think, you know, the Dead reflected technology changes. They were very on top of the latest technical innovations on stage. They even down to using teleprompters. And by the end, they had special microphones on stage that allowed them to talk to each other without the audience hearing.
That was an interesting part to
read. Yeah. I mean, they were, again, like, they were really on top of things in culture and the world, more than you'd expect.
You mentioned how the Dead had gone off and started their own record company, which didn't work out. But the Grateful Dead ended up being a major corporation. And they were not only good to their employees, they were really good to their fans as well. They did some pretty interesting and unusual things. For instance, there were the tapers, who were basically fans that recorded all of their shows. Those tapes meant a lot to their fans, and the Dead created a designated taping section just for them. That sort of open access was unusual, and these things created a type of relationship between them and their fans, didn't they?
Yeah, there were, I think another way in which the Dead paved the way for the modern world is they had this bond, this one-on-one connection with their fan base that I think in some ways paved the way for social media when such a thing didn't exist. They, again, in their archives and from other sources, I saw some of the newsletters that they sent out in the early 70s directly to their fans. They collected names and addresses at shows. They'd have like a little table, and they'd give away posters or whatever, and in exchange for that, you'd give them your address. And soon after that, if you signed up, you would start getting this, you know, little newsletter in the mail. It came randomly, but, you know, but it would show up, and it would be news from their world. Hey, here's what we're doing now. We're making a new record, or we're going on tour, blah, blah, blah. Or, we're starting our own record company. Or, actually, their record company didn't work out, so we're signing with another company. All this sort of information that you would get did show up in your mailbox, which is sort of like primitive tweets or, or Facebook posts. And no one was doing that at the time, you know. No one was establishing that direct connection with fans. It extended to the tapers and allowing them to come in, and by the 80s, having their own special section. The bond that they fostered with their audience was so unusual. I mean, it really made the audience feel like they were part of the experience, that they almost like they knew the band, even if they didn't. it led them to have more and more people coming to shows, like in the 80s, even when they weren't putting out records. So, you know, there was a 7-year gap between 1980 and 1987. They didn't put out a new album. But with each year, they were attracting more people, and by 87, playing stadiums. And that's, again, a testament to the way they nurtured that fan base. They opened their own office to sell tickets directly to those fans. They worked really hard at their business on that end, and with their crew as well, giving them little bits of a certain amount of pot left in each of their little crews. Mailboxes at the office.
And they were
extended across the board.
But they paid them pretty well. They had health care.
They did. I mean, by the time, you know, Jerry died, they were a huge corporation, one of the biggest in California. Depending whether or not they were on tour or not, at a given time, their monthly nut, according to one of their business managers who told me that, was between $500,000 and $750,000 a month that they had to shell out, you know, for salaries, for insurance, for, you know, rental spaces on their buildings and all that. That's a lot of money. But it had its downside, being that they couldn't afford not to go out on tour, even if Jerry's health was failing. They had bills to pay. I think they felt really bad because a lot of the people who worked for them had worked with them for a long time and were friends. It really was a family in that way. And they felt like, well, if we take some time off, even if we have to for Jerry to clean himself up, then we'll have to shut down the operation. We'll have to lay people off. We'll have to, you know, people won't be able to save for their kids' college tuitions or whatever else. And so, you know, that was the downside to the corporation, that it was so big that the machine had to keep rolling.
Mm. My guest is David Brown. He's a music critic, journalist, and has written this book, So Many Roads, The Life and Times of the Grateful Dead. Their music had been criticized, or has been criticized. Some people have actually gone as far as to say that they couldn't really write a song. What do you say to that?
That is one of the most mind-boggling bits of misinformation that I've ever heard. I've heard that for so long. People say, oh, all they knew how to do on stage was noodle on their instruments, and they couldn't really write any songs. The body of work that they've left behind, especially the songs that Garcia wrote with Robert Hunter, is, I think, one of the most enduring set of songs in the whole, you know, rock canon. I mean, just think of the greatest hits, as it were, you know, Sugar Magnolias and Box of Rain, and even Touch of Grey, as commercial, poppy as it was. Jack Straw. I could just go down the list of songs that have really held up as songs. You can actually play them, you know, on a piano or a guitar. There's a reason that Hunter and Garcia are being inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame next month, which is home to everybody from, you know, Stephen Foster and Irving Berlin up to Dylan and so forth. It's because those songs have endured. There have been so many cover versions of those songs. There's a new tribute album in the works right now that's going to feature all these kind of indie rock musicians, you know, members of the National and Vampire Weekend and all those kind of bands covering those songs. And again, that would not be possible if those songs hadn't endured. And part of that reason is, again, goes back to their roots, you know, Garcia in particular and Robert Hunter too.
And we should say Robert Hunter was basically their official lyricist.
They're kind of in-house, they're Bernie Taupin, you know. He's another period in-house lyricist. And he and Jerry came out of that sort of folk acoustic roots music background, and so they weren't coming from jazz. You know, they were coming from an idiom where you had a verse-chorus structure, you had strong melodies, and that was the underpinning of so much of what they did. And yes, they had experimental songs, and they would start with those melodies and then take off in some free-flight thing, but so many of the songs were grounded melodically, structurally, and like I said, and they're being covered and re-recorded to this day. And you know, you can't always say that with you know, a lot of Iron Butterfly songs or something. Yeah.
The Dead weren't a really big album-selling band, as you've pointed out, until the late '80s. What was the story there?
Well, you know, one of the days that I picked as one of my chapters was the day in May of 1987 when they made a video for what was going to be their new single, Touch of Grey. And it was unusual, first of all, for the Dead to make a video. They
really?
Had never done that before. This is a band who were so squirrely that they couldn't even sit still for a photo shoot for past 5 minutes. You know, their publicist at the time told me he would often bring along like a Rodney Dangerfield joke book just so he could keep them all in the same place for 5 minutes, and he would just tell jokes and have them laugh so that they could look like they were having a good time while having their picture taken. So this, you know, again, not their favorite things to do, photo shoots and videos. But they were in a really good spot that spring. They had just finished making an album called In the Dark. They were all relatively healthy. They were thankful that Jerry was alive and that the band still existed. They were all could still make a living. So it was a good feeling, and they agreed to, you know, lip sync on this stage for a couple of hours after one of their performances. And I picked that because it was a fascinating day. A lot of stuff was happening kind of behind the scenes with their crew and with the sort of business stuff of finishing that album and the song. And I think it ended up being a very pivotal day in the sense that that video, combined with the sort of poppy aspect of that song, gave them their first hit single, first platinum album, which is a million selling. And that was a real milestone for them. It also had its dark side because the way MTV latched onto that video, I think we all remember seeing that video with the skeletons, you know,
right.
Over and over again, was good for the band and its finances, but it suddenly brought in this whole new audience, the kind of younger, you know, MTV demo, who now associated the band with partly with music and partly with partying. And MTV itself reinforced that by that summer, during that summer of 87, Touch of Grey summer.
And some of those fans weren't quite as community-oriented or as calm as the old fans.
They weren't, you know. And you know, MTV had a whole thing called The Day of the Dead that summer, a whole special showing, you know, fans partying inside the venue, outside. It reinforced this idea of, hey, you know, you can come and get stoned and not be hassled. wow, what a world. And so you had all these kind of newcomers who meant well in some ways, but didn't know certain rules about gate crashing. You should, you know, there were a lot of rules and standards within the world of the Deadheads and the ones who went to their shows. And, you know, you shouldn't resell your ticket at more than face value, no gate crashing, you know, don't dose someone and then leave.
Right.
You know, there were certain, you know, standards. And a lot of these newcomers didn't know that or didn't care.
Made life very difficult for them.
Yeah, exactly. And so they attracted this new audience with a hit, but that audience wasn't maybe always the one that they wanted. And they're within a couple of years, there were security concerns. There were a lot of incidents with police, and you know, you suddenly had 10,000 people outside a venue who couldn't get in, didn't have tickets, and they just wanted to be there and party and hang out. And police would be overwhelmed. They wouldn't know what to do about this. Again, not something no one had quite witnessed before.
Mm.
So I think the Touch of Grey song and the video was really symbolic of success, but also gave a sign of what was to come, and not always in the best way.
Well, and speaking of what was to come, there's so much information in this book and so many paths we could have gone down. We haven't even mentioned the so-called curse of the keyboard players, which I know you kind of just brush by a little bit and do mention in the book, but you don't really give any real credence to that thought about there being a curse on the keyboard players.
Right. Yeah, it's true. true that three of their keyboardists did die. Actually, I should say four. I mean, three during the period when they were in the band, and the fourth one, Vince Welnick, committed suicide after Jerry died, when there was no band anymore. But you do have, you know, Bruce Hornsby still with us, Tompkins Stanton, T.C., who was briefly a member in the late 60s. He's still around. A guy named Ned Lashian, who was, you know, kind of part of the scene a little bit, did play a little bit with them. He's also still around. So it isn't necessarily a cursed seat. But then again, it's interesting that they picked the three main guys who died during the band's existence, Pigpen and Keith Godshall and Rand Midland. Interesting, all in their way kind of shy, insecure guys. I'm not sure if that was accidental or not, or they wanted that kind of a personality in that chair.
Hmm.
Yeah, and in the case of, I think in the case of Keith and Brand, it seems like they kind of got swept up in the whole culture of the band, the good and the bad, and wanted to kind of, you know, got kind of ensnared in it, or maybe in Brent's case, wanted to kind of keep up with the excesses as a way to kind of show he was not just the new guy, you know. I think he was plagued with thoughts about that, and that he wasn't a real member of the band, and because he felt some fans liked his predecessor more, and that they didn't like his songs as much. And Brent Midland was a fascinating guy, and I was able to speak with you know, one of his early girlfriends and one of his early band leaders. I got a little more information about his backstory, I think, than we've seen in some of the other books. And I wanted to do that purposely also because, not only because I found it fascinating that he came from a military background and so forth, but Brent was, for all of his insecurities, he was a really beloved figure by those new generation of dead fans in the 80s. He was the youngest guy in the band, it's true, and I think a lot of fans loved him. I spoke with many 80s deadheads who loved Brent's energy on stage and his youthful vigor, the fact that he was like the best singer in the band. The other guys kind of waver.
Mm-hmm.
Brent was like spot on singer, really strong. He had kind of a Michael McDonald type voice, which rubbed some people the wrong way, but just as many people loved that. They loved his songs, and they were more personal and direct. They were, you know, love songs, songs about his own, you know, troubles that a lot of people could really relate to. And yet, Brent never or rarely seemed to feel that love. It was tragic. There's so many tragic elements to the Grateful Dead story. I mean, Jerry, certainly, and Brent Midland, another one, that made the story, you know, at times it was fun to write about all these escapades, and other times you realize it could be a really sad tale.
This is David Brown. He's a music critic, and we're talking with him about his book, So Many Roads, The Life and Times of the Grateful Dead. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in for Faith. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with David Brown.
Look out of any window, any morning, any evening, any day. Maybe the sun is shining, birds are winging, no rain is falling from a heavy sky.
I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in for Faith. We're talking about the book So Many Roads, The Life and Times of the Grateful Dead by my guest, David Brown. He's a music critic and journalist. His book is just out, and in time to mark the 50th anniversary of the Grateful Dead, we've talked about their success, some of their challenges, but we haven't talked about the end of the band, which comes after the death of Jerry Garcia 20 years ago. His death left a big hole and had a huge impact. Let's talk about that.
It's hard to overestimate the impact on the band. I mean, he was the glue that held those guys together. Even though he, again, did not like to be seen as the leader, he pretty much was. You know, he would ultimately make the decisions in meetings, even if he was quiet for a long time. He would eventually speak up, and whatever he wanted, people pretty much went with. He was the person they all had in common, you know. And without him there, it's never been the same, to say the least. And I think they all grappled with, like, what to do next. I mean, you know, Bob Weir was only in his mid-40s when Jerry died. It wasn't like they were ready to retire. You had all these different factions and solo groups, and, you know, they would reunite occasionally and then to go back to their own bands. And it splintered the whole world of the band. It splintered the fans to some degree. Was Bob's band better than Phil's band, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, there's still those debates online.
Right.
It totally decimated the business of the Dead. There were layoffs immediately, especially of the road crew, because they weren't going to be touring stadiums anymore. It had such a domino effect, even up to a point about 10 years ago when there was a website that was streaming concert recordings. And up until that point, like with the tapers, Dead didn't have an issue with people passing around tapes and so forth, because they were making so much money on the road, touring several times a year, often playing stadiums, and they were making a ton of money when, up until Jerry died. And suddenly, you know, that spigot was shut. And when the digital era came and people are now trading tapes and streaming things online, they found themselves in this position of having to shut down. Some of those recordings have been pulled from this site. It caused all kinds of, you know, ill will between some Deadheads and the band members. This sense of, wait, what are you doing? You've always liked this. What's the problem? And but it was a sense of, well, maybe we shouldn't give this away for free. We should sell this stuff, and because how else are we going to make a living? You know?
Wow.
I mean, they can still tour and play smaller places, but they're not playing, other than these Fare Thee Well shows in Chicago and California, they're not playing stadiums anymore. And they haven't played those venues in a really, really long time. And so, again, that's just one example of the way that Jerry's death impacted on, like, every aspect of their lives.
You mentioned the farewell shows. You've got an article in Rolling Stone magazine right now where you talk about this upcoming tour in the making. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. It's a story called The Dead After Jerry, and it goes into their lives the last 20 years. I'd say half of the article is about what led up to these farewell shows and the sort of disagreements they've had with each other, and the times they did come together for reunion tours in the past. It's been a sort of constant dance, you know, the last 20 years of reunions, then they fall apart, then they try to get together again, and again, just searching for that common ground that they have with each other without Jerry being around. And you know, I also explored the planning that went into these shows, which was very delicate, because there's still a lot of bruised feelings and a lot of ill will. You can only imagine any of us, let's say you started working with guys and women who you knew, you know, like in high school, because let's face it, when they got together, they were between the age of whatever, 16 and 22 or something, you know. So imagine people you knew in high school or early college, and 50 years later, you're kind of still working with them.
Sure.
And you can imagine the 50 years of, like, grudges and issues that any of us would have, I mean, with anybody.
Sure.
You know,
well, it was like a marriage plus a business together, really.
Yeah, yeah. And so a lot of that had to be gotten over. They had very careful negotiations for this tour, even down to choosing Trey Anastasio of Phish. He seemed like the right guy. There was no baggage with him, with other members, whereas other guitarists maybe had some of that, the other people who'd taken Jerry's place. So the story goes into planning and the fact that They've decided to put it all aside and at least, you know, come together one last time. They're saying this is it. The last time the four guys, four surviving core members will play together. And I kind of believe that.
Do you? That was my next question. Yeah. We've heard this before.
Well, you know, we have. Pop music history is filled with people, you know, from Sinatra to David Bowie and so forth, and The Who, you know, all saying, this is our farewell tour. I mean, I think The Who's first farewell tour was like 1982,
yeah.
You know, and they're still doing one now. You know, in the Dead's case, I take it more seriously because, first of all, they're all getting up there. I mean, Phil West just turned 75 this year, and they're not the proverbial spring chickens anymore. And I think the way they've announced this, they've made it so clear that this is it. You know, like you might see two or three other guys play together in the future, and I bet we will. But as far as all four of them, I actually take that pretty seriously. You know, given the sort of celebratory nature of these shows and the ticket prices, I think if they did something else again with the four of them, it would sort of taint it for a lot of people.
Well, and they've sold out, too. Didn't it start with one location, and we're up to two now?
It's two locations, five shows total. Yeah, there was such a demand. And there was, I think, a real interest in having them not just play in Chicago. You know, I think that was a real head-scratcher for a lot of people. And I think that shows the sort of fragility of their reunion as well. I mean, they didn't want to do a big tour. They could have probably made $1 zillion if they'd done a full month or two tour. But I think relations are such that I think it was just like, no, let's just keep it to a confined couple of shows and over and done with. And I think that, to me, says as much about the fact that we may not see the four of them play together again as well as the announcement, the fact that they've limited it. And you know, to their credit, you know, a lot of people have said, oh, look, these shows are a money grab. They're not making money. If they really wanted to do a money grab, they would go on tour and play stadiums like across the country for a month. They'd make, you know, they really make a lot of money.
Sure. And these are, the way it is set up right now, at five shows total,
yeah,
starting in June.
There are three in Chicago at Soldier Field, which is the last place they played.
And that would be in July.
And then they're doing two shows the weekend before that at the Levi Stadium in Santa Clara, California, which is actually right near that Menlo Park, Palo Alto area where they started in the pizza parlor. So there's a sort of poetic symmetry that they're doing the first farewell shows right near where they started, and then the last farewell shows at the last place they played with Jerry. I kind of like that. There's a nice symmetry to that.
David, I want to just circle back for a minute. At the beginning of the show, we talked about the layout of the book and how each chapter begins with a key date in the band's history. It occurs to me, because there are so many stories and there's so much history, that it must have been pretty difficult to choose those dates. How did you decide which dates to settle on?
It was a long, drawn-out process that I took very seriously. And what I did was, at the very beginning of the project, I started putting together a chronology of dates. And every time I came across a significant date, whether it was a birth or a death or a recording session or a notable show or an arrest, you know, any of those things, I just threw it all into this chronology, which by the time I was done was, you know, 20, 30 pages when I printed it out. And so, yeah, I had this massive chronology, and then I just started, you know, circling particular important, interesting days and figuring out, okay, which one would represent this era best and which one would have the most information, too. That was another big challenge. If I wanted to take a reader through a day, I had to pick days where I had enough research from interviews and documents that I knew what sort of happened over the course of those 24 or so hours. Each chapter also gives you some backstory as to what happened in the years leading up to that day. And so I was able to hopefully weave all of that together and still adhere to my basic kind of microstructure of each chapter.
You spent a few years researching for this book. You've written extensively about the band in the past. Did you learn anything that surprised you?
Boy, that's a good question. I feel like there's so many things I learned. I certainly, like we talked about earlier, I think, you know, Jerry's intensity and his sort of grumpy side, you know. I mean, Jerry could be a bit of a difficult guy, I think, when he wanted to be, when things weren't going well, especially musically, or if people were on his case about something. I think that's an aspect of his personality didn't really know about, some of those aspects of their business and how demanding they were early on was really interesting. I mean, I came across one contract for a concert in the early 70s in Connecticut where they basically, you know, every contract has a space where it says showtime, you know, blank, end time blank, and you fill those things in. And like this one contract that just says, you know, Grateful Dead will play for as long as they want to play. You know? And this is before they had any hits, or, you know, they were a growing popular band, but, you know, I was surprised as early as 1971 that they were making those kind of demands, you know, on people.
Right, especially here in Connecticut.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. One of the amazing things I got to hear was a tape that's in their archives of a band meeting in 1968 where, you know, essentially Bob Weir and Pigpen were fired. I've heard about this meeting.
Oh, you had in the past? You had heard about this?
I'd heard about it, but I hadn't actually heard it until I went to their archives. And it's a fascinating oral document in that, you know, you kind of hear Jerry and Phil Lesh and their manager kind of leading the way and basically kind of saying, you know, you guys, you're not really on the ball, you got to get better. They weren't actually fired, but there was a very strong message, like, you got to get your act together or else we're just going off on our own, we're leaving you behind. Even when those guys did come back, the Dead did have a habit early on in their career in the late 60s, early 70s of taping all their shows, which we're all benefit now from because those tapes now exist. But after each show, they would get together in a hotel room or wherever they were, and they'd listen back to it and often brutally criticize each other. Like, you played that wrong. You know, they even, like, one of the road crew taped one of those shows told me they'd even, like, turn on me if the recording quality of one instrument wasn't good. You're always in the bullseye, you know, with those guys. And so it was that kind of atmosphere. And, you know, I think in a way it made them last as long as they did. But it also, you know, unfortunately resulted in a fair amount of casualties. And so, you know, it was really interesting to learn about that. It was really interesting to learn more about Brent Midland and his story. There was really new information for me about his troubles. So, yeah, it seemed like everywhere I turned, I learned more about Jerry's the sense of fatalism that he had. You know, I think he grew up seeing his life change on a dime. You know, his father drowned when he was very young. One of his best friends died in a car crash, and Jerry was in the car at the time. And so he, you know, and even the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think, fed into that because he thought, you know, the world could end tonight. And I think that fed into his sense, as his girlfriend described to me and others have as well, that, you know, you might as well just live in the moment because the world could change at any moment. And I think it's kind of in the way he lived his life, and there wasn't a whole lot of future planning. It was just like, let's just live for the moment, enjoy this time. And, you know, that had its downside, too, in terms of his drug problems and so forth.
The book is jam-packed with information, history, and lots of stories. Thanks for writing this book, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Lori, so much. It was great to be here.
David Brown is the author of So Many Roads, The Life and Times of the Grateful Dead. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening.
From the land of the midnight sun, where the ice blue roses grow. Along those roads of gold and silver stone. Howling wide among the low, so many roads. So many roads to ease my soul. So many roads to ease my soul. So many roads to ease my soul. So many roads to ease my soul.